de mevziye fırlayan, canını savaşa dayan. Yorgunluk, açsızlık demeden, yılmadan savaşır gerilla. Yorgunluk, açsızlık demeden, yılmadan savaşır gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Halkının umudu gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Cihanın umudu gerilla. Sabahın ilk ışıklarıyla yer gök inimin inliyor. Sabahın ilk ışıklarıyla halkanlar içinde uzanmış, göğsü paramparça gerilla. Halkanlar içinde uzanmış, göksü paramparça gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Halkının umudu gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Cihanın umudu gerilla. Canımızı adarız uğruna düştüğüm kavgaya. Biz de canımızı adarız uğruna düştüğüm kavgaya. Ter baktıkça karanam bu ya, seni anacağız gerilla. Ter baktıkça karanım bu ya, seni anacağız gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Halkının umudu gerilla. Ha gerilla, gerilla, gerilla. Cihanın
Hello, everybody. Welcome to number 5 of our 5-part series of seminars, Lessons from Rojava, How Our Social Movements Can Learn from the Rojava Revolution. So this one's called What Next for Social Movements in the UK? And we're going to be hearing from a few different people who organised in the KSN here in the UK. So I'm Jo, and I'm part of the KSN. Please keep your cameras and microphones turned off during the session, just to help people's connections and things like that. We've got people keeping an eye on the chat, both on Facebook and on Zoom. So please introduce yourself there. And if you ask any questions that you've got as we go along, then they'll be fed back to the speakers and there'll be a space for that near the end. But you can ask questions at any time. So what is the KSN? The Kurdistan Solidarity Network is a network of grassroots community groups, local groups in different places, London, Brighton, Bristol, Manchester, Cornwall, and there's a group joining in Wales. People organised in Kurdistan Solidarity Network groups, which also includes working groups, by the way. So these seminars are being organised by the Education Working Group of the KSN. people organized in KSN structures are coming from a lot of different social movements as well. So between us, we've got a lot of different experiences of being part of grassroots social movements in the UK for quite some time. So we're going to speak today a bit about that and looking forward to what's next, where can we go from here, what's going on. So we're going to start with me. So I'm Jo. I got involved in grassroots political organising 13 years ago. I've been part of a range of different ecological movements, community organising, struggles for freedom of movement in solidarity with people being criminalised for trying to cross borders. Like most people, I got involved with this kind of work because I believe that we can do better. People are generally not paid for this kind of work, but it's something that we do because of a real need to try and change things and to try and make this world a better place for more people. And it is a big struggle. Like, the environment, the natural world are being destroyed. Profit comes before people's lives in a lot of cases, especially in the global south, but also across class lines, kind of everywhere in the world. Every day people die trying to cross borders, which other people can cross easily because of a document they carry in their pocket. The natural world is being ripped apart. There's wars being carried out all over the world. There's massive wealth inequality, especially here in the UK, which is one of the most unequal countries in the world. So the house is on fire, and the way that we often come to these social movements is from a kind of a drive towards something better, yes, but also a kind of panic, like the house is on fire and we need to put it out. So this is kind of firefighting approach. People get caught up in hyperactivism cycles, just kind of trying to do whatever we can think of doing, which isn't necessarily the most sort of strategic approach a lot of the time. And people get burnt out and people drop out of social movements. And because we can be organized often in quite a spontaneous kind of way, like whoever has the energy and the motivation can do more of the work, but we don't necessarily have very strong structures where we're kind of developing our political organization as well. We can tend to focus our energies on just one thing, one campaign, one issue, or on a bunch of things, but in a way that becomes quite connected to a lifestyle rather than a belief that our actions can change things. So I think a lot of this has got to do with hope, and I want to talk a bit about hope and my sort of the way that my perception of that has shifted. So I was politicized largely in the anarchist movement, especially the eco-anarchist movement. And there was a text by a guy called Derek Jensen called Beyond Hope, where he argues, for me at that time quite convincingly, that we should reject the idea of hope and kind of get rid of our hope, because he frames hope as this kind of abstract belief that our actions can lead to a particular result. And especially being organized in this kind of way, that's often not the case, right? Like, we do campaigns, sometimes a single issue campaign can reach its result, and that's great, and we have successes all the time, but we're not changing the system itself. And so he argues that we should just engage in positive action in struggle for its own sake, for its own reward. And I really this really affected me, basically, and this was the kind of line that I was organizing on for a long time. So a few years ago, I went to Rojava for a pretty brief period of time as part of a women's delegation. So it was with the women's movement. And I really saw for the first time what a very organized, strong social movement can look like and what it's capable of achieving if it has a really strong political vision and really strong organization and a real belief. So it's a real revolution that is also something that I wasn't necessarily fully expecting. Like, I had a lot of like doubts and concerns before I went there. But it's a real revolution, and it's being led by women, and this is what I saw. And so this changed everything for me, really, because I thought, okay, if there's actually a revolution, it means revolution is possible, and therefore my actions can have a result. So therefore I shouldn't just do whatever I can think of doing and put my energy into, you know, this hyperactivism cycle, but there's a need to be strategic and to be really organized and to develop ourselves and our organizing structures. So if we believe that change is possible, then this changes the way that we approach the work. And another important component of this is the really long-term thinking. So the Rojava revolution is the result of 40 years of struggle. And we also need to look further than, you know, the next win or the next target. And we need to really think about decades of struggle. I know a lot of people are going to say, you know, the house is literally on fire. We haven't got that long left before ecological collapse. But by basing our struggle on this long-term commitment, you know, we have much more chance actually of developing a more sustainable system that is capable of, you know, sustaining the planet for a longer time, basically. So we need a deep understanding of who we are and where we are and how things got like this. So this relates to our history, and that's something that we're going to keep coming back to today. We need a strong belief that transformation is possible and a coherent political vision, which is capable of holding and working with contradictions, with all those difficult issues that complicate and muddy the water. And a long-term commitment to doing the work in our communities, in our relationships, and in ourselves, because social change is inherently social. We're talking about transforming social relationships. And a lot of the time, this isn't something that we want to think about necessarily as part of our political organising. So we need to understand the system we're living in. We need to understand the state, the capitalist system, and liberalism, which is the political ideology connected to it. So these are ideas, frameworks, and ideologies that we've all grown up with, but we've been so much a part of it, and it and us, that we often don't see the wood for the trees. So when I was a kid, right up to my teenage years, Margaret Thatcher was in power here, and she said there's no such thing as society. Well, this is really important because the Kurdish freedom movement is saying, like, society actually is the most important thing, and we shouldn't see ourselves as separate from it, but we should see ourselves as part of it and change it, like, as, you know, with that framework, with that understanding. And a lot of this is to do with the stories about individualism that we're told as part of the sort of liberal capitalist ideology that we don't really even realise is part of that system. So at school, we're taught about stranger danger, and we're kind of taught that it's a dog-eat-dog world, and we've got to, you know, be successful kind of as an individual and look out for ourselves first. And our whole idea about care and self-care is based on this really individual sort of self-centered, like looking at the self approach. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't do self-care, but there's a different kind of framework that can sit in that is actually a lot more nourishing and gives us more strength than if we see it in an individual way. So we need to understand how these stories affect us and the way we treat each other and the way we live our lives, and how that affects our political organising. So the pandemic, first the pandemic, and now also the situation which has started in the United States and is sort of spreading around the world, where people are seeing, I guess, a lot of them for the first time, what Black and brown people have known all along, which is that the system's inherently unequal and built on a foundation of racism. So people are seeing this violence kind of more in front of their eyes, and it's ruptured, it's shifted the political landscape, and it's ruptured our perception of normal. Like, if 6 months ago you told me that all of the pubs in the whole country are going to close because of a pandemic, I would be like, what are you talking about? So we need to really recognize these moments, because these are moments when a lot more is possible, because we don't really believe a lot of the time that change is possible. When we see something completely unexpected happening, then this, it creates a possibility for people to understand that more change is possible. So this session is called What Next for Social Movements in the UK. So I started making a mind map of all the different parts of it that already exist, places where I see hope. And it started to look a bit like a tree. So I decided to go with it and make it into an actual picture of a tree, which might be a useful metaphor for us. It might not be, I don't know, just go with it. So the branches came to represent kind of tendencies and methodologies, and the leaves are the physical manifestations of these things, like unions, groups, movements, campaigns, projects. So it's an imperfect metaphor, and I'm going to ask you to not get caught up in the details and like fixate on specific words and things like that. There's loads of things missing from this tree. It's a 2D tree, and you just need to imagine like hundreds of branches and thousands of leaves, like out of shot, behind the tree, above, like everywhere. This tree was drawn by a white working class, mostly English woman, who's been involved with a particular set of social movements. And so that's the perspective also that the tree is drawn from. I also left a lot of branches kind of unfinished, so you can fill them in with your imagination. So the important thing about this metaphor is to see that all these leaves and branches are part of the whole tree. It's a living, breathing organism nourished by its roots of history and those who've gone before us and opened up paths of resistance. And it's held together by the trunk, which is organization. So I'm going to just leave you with the question, what would it look like to develop a shared understanding and coherent political vision between all the movements that we're part of, and to develop strategies based on this understanding, to find ways to work together with all of our conflicts and contradictions towards a better world? So now I'm going to hand over to the next speaker. So the next speaker has made a video for us. It's Helef. Helef has been part of the Welsh language movement and different local campaigns with South Wales anarchists and the prison abolition movement. And at the moment, she's focusing on genealogy, which we've talked about in previous sessions, as part of the Kurdish women's movement's sort of proposal for a new social science based on liberation, with like women's liberation at its heart. So can we play Helef's video?
I'm going to try and answer the questions. What does it mean to be a revolutionary? Is it possible in this context? And what's needed for this? So my background is kind of, I came into politics through the Welsh language movement, and it's something that's just sort of normal in Welsh speaking areas of Wales, because people have had to fight tooth and nail for all the opportunities we have to use Welsh. It's a language that's losing speakers, so people are always afraid of that the language is going to die. And I grew up going to demonstrations, listening to music, supporting the movement, and being told the history of the movement and of Wales as a separate entity to England. And this feels like something that was familiar to the Kurdish movement. Like when I got involved in the solidarity group for a friend of mine that Imam says that went on hunger strike last year, I already knew about the Kurdish revolution, especially since a friend of mine had gone there and had died there now. And the tradition they have there of remembering the people that died for them, the martyrs, the songs they share, the pictures on the wall, and the way they remember together what happened and share the history. It's like a fighting culture that's aware of where it's come from, and that feels like, in the context of being a revolutionary, that feels like an important part. And it felt like something that was a little bit missing when I got involved in anarchist politics and in more the general left, beyond the Welsh language movement. I feel like this kind of, in the UK, the far right seems to grab onto the identity and the history and make it their own, when actually it's ours. Like, the history of struggle in England, Wales and everywhere like this, it's our history, and we shouldn't let the far right take it. There's far right elements in the Welsh independence movement as well that try to do these kind of things, but it's more so in England, because obviously, as England is a colonial power, maybe people on the left find it very hard to connect with English history and English culture in this way. But I think that we can't forget, we need, especially in light of the Black Lives Matter movement, we need to learn the colonial history, but also we need to take from the traditions of struggle and weave it into our history, as a movement. I feel that in the another part of what feels a revolution wasn't a word I would use before I sort of came into the Kurdish solidarity sort of movement. In the Welsh language, Chwildo, the sort of tagline for the Welsh language movement was that it's part of the non-violent international revolution for rights and freedoms. And revolution didn't feel the same as it did when I say it in English. When I thought revolution, I thought of all these sort of socialist groups that have lots of meetings about theory and trying to recruit members and sort of bandwagon on causes. And that was my first interaction with like pure like socialist sort of thought. But what in encountering the Kurdish movement, it's I've kind of rethought it a lot, and I've rethought like a lot of the attitudes I had towards other people on the left. Like we're all, it's so sectarianism, but and it feels especially the bigger the town or city you're in, the more sectarian you are, because the more luxury you have to go into your own bubble. But I feel that like seeing all of us together in the same tradition, anarchists, socialists, people that are fighting for language rights, people that are fighting for disabled people's rights, people fighting for anti-colonial struggle and for the rights of people of colour, and everything else. I just feel that we need to have like stuff to make sure that like people that have privilege are understand the history and what they the privilege they hold, but also to feel that they can be part of the struggle. It's yeah, in the UK it feels impossible to see and imagine a revolution, but a revolution, when if people hear revolution, maybe they think of things that happen in the global south, but for me it's, you know, creating the new society in the shell of the old, like is happening in Rojava, and the Black Panthers did in their 10-point programs, survival pending revolution. The things that the state and capitalism doesn't provide for us, that we get organized and provide for ourselves and our communities, but that these structures are an inherent part of the push for revolution is as well, like the whole way that NGOs and asking the government for funding and all these things. It doesn't mean that we should never take funding from government or things like this. I just feel like that way that social movements have been NGO-ified, like the Welsh language movement, like campaigns against militarism, they've fragmented more and more into single issue things that don't have this overarching kind of drive for social change as a whole. Yeah, people say nominally that they want societal change, but in substance it's, yeah, I feel that there needs, from learning from the Kurdish movement, things need to be more interconnected, and we need to find the common thread of humanity within each other and try and not be dogmatic. I was terribly dogmatic in the time I was an anarchist. But the thing is, there's people that believe, we all have such strong common beliefs. People from religious groups, people that are anarchists and socialists, communists, people that just want a better world for their kids and themselves and their communities. And of course there's red lines that we can't cross, but if you in the right context, if you find the common thread, that common thread of humanity between everyone, and nurture it and try and grow it, like in when I was learning about the Kurdish freedom movement, something someone said really struck me, and they said politics is the art of people and we're artists. And I thought that's so true, like when we are organizing, we are nurturing people to become organizers, to help people gain more confidence, we're also trying to change ourselves, because this society that's driven by profit and control and individualism, it's really, you know, it's really had a massive effect on our personalities. I think the system's traumatised everyone, even the most privileged people. I think none of us are free. People are, like, you know, chained by their privilege, as well as the, like, these billionaires. I think they, what kind of life do they really have? They've got a meaningless life. And then on the other side, you've got 24,000 people that die of starvation every day, most of them under five. And you just think of the kind of world we live in, and it's just not good enough. Never mind the things about global warming that's, like, coming towards us quickly, and just how people live in... how people live and relate to each other in this kind of society. It's not right. But I feel that the abolitionist movement, because I've always felt like I didn't know what to do to change society. As an anarchist, I believed in revolution, but I thought it wasn't possible, but I can work towards something. And I always went to the causes that seemed to be the most urgent, like, oh, anti-militarism, because, you know, the violence of war is one of the most actually horrendous things. Or the Welsh language movements before that, because it felt like something that was relevant to me and my community and the way I could make a change. And then when my members of my family went to prison, and friends of mine went to prison and actually died quite quickly after coming out, because I think partly of how traumatising the experience was, I got involved in the prison abolition movement, which had a lot of different campaigns we were working on, but, and it was reflective, and it came from the tradition of prison abolition in America, which is like a movement led by people of colour. And this movement had within it the idea of revolution, that for a prison-free world, that we need safety, accountability, we need our needs met. And it felt like in so many things that focused on one aspect of society, it did encapsulate the whole idea of changing the world. But it felt like still everything, it was difficult to try and make a change, it felt, and to grow the movement. And because and also working with prisoner families are usually working class people, face a lot of discrimination and problems, and the people affected worst by the system are the ones kept most busy by the system, being poor and being, like, chaotic and struggling. And then the other people don't really understand why the system needs to change, perhaps, unless they've got some kind of compassionate streak that, you know, to have the time and do that. But it's still kind of like, sometimes it felt like it was a hobby or something people like to do on the side, like a bit of volunteering rather than a way of life. So to be a revolutionary, I feel like it's something that, you know, directs your life and informs your life, and it's a way you believe in the world and the way you believe in the potential of human beings. And I feel like from being involved in the Kurdish solidarity movement, I've learned so much stuff that's really, it's just the sheer deep reflection, like things like techmil people use to try and work on themselves and evaluate. Like, I feel like I've been doing this similar thing for 10 years, and it always gets the same results, and it feels like how this isn't working. And there's things other people in this video probably talk about, but I've just finished reading Asata Shakur's book, and I feel like in a lot of ways the Kurdish freedom movement and the Black Panthers had a lot of ideas in common, and I feel like these movements are like highly sophisticated and we can really learn a lot from them. Thanks for listening, and I really hope that you get a lot from this session. I'm looking forward to hearing everyone else what they say as well.
Great, so now we've got Nick. So Nick is a social historian and an international in the Kurdish Freedom Movement.
Thanks, Jo. So what I'm going to try and do in this section is to build on what Heleth was, some of the points that Heleth was just making, and try to answer one basic question, which is why thinking about history is a necessary next step for social movements in the so-called United Kingdom and really across the Irish and British Isles. And then at the end, what I'm going to do is just introduce one concept from the Kurdish Freedom Movement that will be an essential tool for thinking about history. So the Kurdish Freedom Movement has a real emphasis on understanding our past. And the basic reason for this is the same as many revolutionaries have recognized. That is, as humans, we make our own history, but not in conditions that we choose. We inherit our circumstances from the past generations. And so in order to make history consciously, which means to change society for the better, we need to properly understand the conditions that we've inherited. In the words of the Zapatistas, we need to walk forwards while looking backwards. Now, what does this mean for revolutionaries in these islands? One thing I've learned from doing radical history workshops in different political spaces is how much understandings of history vary among revolutionaries and different traditions, both in terms of the time span or the historical depth that they think with, and in terms of the important events. And I think it's really important to see these different choices about what historical depth you go to and what events you focus in on as representing two things: the system that these revolutionaries are identifying, when it begins and what its characteristics are, and then the other world, the free life that is envisioned as taking this system's place. So we can see these assumptions there implicitly if we choose, say, to start 40 years ago, as Joe mentioned at the beginning, with Thatcher and the political and economic changes that get referred to as neoliberalism and globalization. Or we could go 200 years ago with the Industrial Revolution, or maybe we'd go 500 years ago with merchant capitalism, the birth of modern empire and colonialism, or 5,000 years if we wanted to go to the start of the state system, or 10,000 years for the first agriculture. All of these represent different assumptions about what the system is that we're trying to overcome, and on the other hand, what we're trying to replace this with. And the same thing is said of the different events, right? These are taken as symbols of real shifts or high points in struggle that show who we understand our historical ancestors as, and what we're trying to do in making history. So one really good example was a workshop that I did with it was a timeline exercise, and it really sticks in my mind because it was completely clear just from looking at the different timelines that the different groups were setting out, what political traditions the people who were in that groups came from. So you might have people from an eco-anarchist background going back to the birth of agriculture. And then on the other hand, you'd have communist comrades from the workers' movement who were shocked to find out that no one had put down the October Revolution in 1917. And then on the other hand, there are a small handful of events that somehow seem to cross between the different traditions, like the Peasants' Revolt in 1381 or the Enclosure Movement. And these seem to represent something interesting about what history is understood already to just be important for all radicals. But of course, every tradition's historical perspective adds something to the rich tapestry of past struggles. So the question is how we could begin building an integrated and a shared historical perspective. And on the importance of history in general, I think the last few days with the uprisings taking place around the world, but particularly how they're taking place in the territory governed by the United Kingdom and the British state. It's really taught us just how contested this history is, or rather maybe should be, and so how important struggle is over it. Countless more people will have looked into Winston Churchill as the man rather than the myth in the last few days than in all the years of people glancing at a silent statue that celebrates him in one dimension. And also the state's response to this shows how much energy they put into presenting and protecting one version of history. We now have a situation in the UK where both major parties are backing 10-year sentences for defacing statues. That really shows how much the state, our enemy, if we want to put it that way, values history and values a certain version of it, and suggests how importantly we should hold it as well. And maybe most importantly, what this obviously represents is the importance as a country now significantly of migrant and diaspora communities, how we can build that understanding into our political vision in a way that comes to terms with the legacy of empire and the historical perspective that still keeps this as one pointing to the liberation of everyone. So I, for example, along with many other people in these islands, have the history of empire deeply embedded in my own family and in my own lived experience. From working class Scots who went to work in India and intermarried with local Bengalis, as colonial subjects in Cyprus, as Irish labourers moving to England for work. I myself was born in Hong Kong, a colony, because of the work that my dad was doing there. So how can we have a vision of a past that encompasses all of this without forcing those of us who have mixed heritages to have that familiar experience of feeling forced to choose between one or another past that's really yours, and a vision that's also all of ours, but without performing that trick of liberal multiculturalism, which attempts to celebrate diversity, but only by erasing the violence that created this diversity to a great degree in the first place. So I think the answers to these questions will be given by many, many different collectives, different movements, different organizations, rightly, because that will represent the diversity of people in these islands. But at the same time, all together we'll need an approach that has a shared perspective, a shared set of values that guide it. And this starts from some basic points. A recognition that it's a political necessity that we both know ourselves and we know the system that we're living in. And this means understanding the different roots of both that go deep into the earth of history. To know ourselves and understand ourselves as products of the combined struggles of generations of people, of all genders, of many varying ethnic, racial, religious identifications, coming from different subordinated classes, from different urban and rural regions, near and far, all of their struggles are embodied in all of us. And at the same time, we need to understand the roots of the, and understand the historical totality of the system we're looking to overcome, the system in its whole as it's developed historically. So that's the argument for why history is a necessary immediate political task for social movements in these islands. And to end then, I'm just going to turn to one concept that the Kurdish Freedom Movement and its lead political philosopher Abdullah Öcalan have developed to help us with this task. So to help us visualize this, I've chosen a picture of the Aragvi River, which is in Georgia, and the moment where the two main tributaries to the Aragvi River, the so-called white Aragvi and the blue Aragvi, which you can see very clearly there, there's a white half and a blue half, where they meet and come together, but the two rivers are still clearly discernible side by side. And what this is a visualization for is the concept of two rivers of history, which Abdullah Öcalan develops in his prison writings. And what these two rivers of history are meant to do is invert this common story that we've all heard. That is, for the vast majority of human history, we lived in pre history. Hunter-gatherers wandering so-called simple societies and essentially not being differentiated from nature. Then a new stage of so-called prehistory starts with agriculture, but agriculture, in this story at least, points directly towards complex society, surplus, class, and the state. And at this point, the state becomes necessary, because if it didn't come about, then all complex society would be is the war of everyone against everyone else. Now, obviously, I can't go too much into the specifics of this story now, but we can say that the evidence is piling up on top of each other that this is simply false. That for 5,000 years before the first state systems, you had settled agriculture, you had complex societies, that nomadic societies operate at scales that people didn't imagine before. So it's just simply not true that you need the state to organize our societies. So what is this story actually doing? What is this one river of history trying to tell us? Well, as Jo hinted at in her introduction, it's telling us you have no agency. The effects of your actions are only important insofar as a state can organize it and defend you from yourself. Now, what Abdullah Öcalan is doing and the Kurdish freedom movement with these two rivers of history is saying, no, that's not the case. Actually, states are vanishingly rare historically. They come about only in a handful of places. And what they represent from that point on is a separation from society, a new stream, if you want. The state is the diversion from the mainstream of human society. And that came about in those rare situations because people began to believe that they needed this structure, that they had a worldview that made this structure possible before the state came about. And then after that, for most of the world, for most of the way in which the state has been spread, it has come about through violence, through the violence of this form spreading from these so-called cradles of civilization. So what this other stream represents, this river of freedom, is all the generations of all the genders and ethnicities and races and subordinated classes who have said no, who have built a meaningful life based on real social relationships, not because of, but despite the state. And not only because they wanted to, but because they had to, because love and care and support and solidarity are the dark matter of history. It's the only thing that has kept us alive while we've been looking to overcome all of the limitations that are set in front of us, and especially to resist against the state. So this metaphor then can become a really effective tool for us to think with, and to train our eyes to see where this constant need for love, for care, for support, and for solidarity has created the base for resistance. There's a lot of talk in left organizing at the moment about the concept of base building, the concept of trying to recreate those communities that were the basis for the historic resistances of the last 100 years, for the workers' movement, for the women's movement, and an idea that what we need to do is to recreate those, and then what we'll be able to do is resist on that same scale. But our task now is not to try and create those out of nothing, but by looking at our histories to see the seedlings of resistance that always already exist everywhere. Not again because people want to or because they're always doing it consciously, but because they need to. Because in the words of the Kurdish freedom movement, resistance is life. It's what creates the potential for a free life constantly. And it's only by looking at these seeds and by tending them into deeply rooted, mighty forests of resistance that we're going to be able to get to that free life that's always already possible. Thanks.
Thanks, Nick. Okay, so now we've got our final speaker, I think. It's Vian. So Vian is an internationalist who's been involved in feminist, climate, anti-fascist and solidarity struggles in the UK. She spent a year working with the Kurdish freedom movement in northeast Syria, and she's now involved in the KSN. Take it away, Vian.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. So I'm here to talk about the very small issue of organization, the trunk of the tree. And I've got 10 minutes to try to sketch out what I mean by organization, touch on what stops us from being organized and how that has an impact on our social movements, and then try to put forward some proposals or some ideas about what that could look like in the UK if we were to have a more organized, coherent, and coordinated social movement. So first of all, I'm going to ask, well, what does organization mean? So it often makes me first think of things like, you know, bureaucracy and lists and processes and spreadsheets and things like that. And however fantastic all those things are, I'm going to try to talk about organization in a bit more of like an organic way, or I guess an ecological way. My background in kind of ecological food growing, so I do love the tree metaphor. And if we think about how, for example, a tree is organized, or how a forest, how any ecosystem is organized, you see all the different parts of the system are working towards a shared goal of some kind. You know, the leaves of the tree are bringing sun to the whole tree, the roots are bringing the water up to the leaves. And if one part of the tree gets hurt in some way, actually the whole tree goes into action to try to remedy that. If you look at a whole forest, you know, a forest isn't just a collection of trees, it's a collection of relationships between all the trees and other living organisms, the pollinators, the fungus, the decaying plant matter. It's all interlinked. And I could talk about this for hours, but I won't. But when I talk about organization, this trunk of our tree metaphor, I try to think not just in terms of, you know, meetings and assemblies and things like that, although that will be necessary, but also this kind of idea of there being a shared unity of purpose. And unity doesn't mean uniformity, like there's diversity, there's a lot of coordination. And there's also sometimes conflict and contradiction and tension, but still throughout all of those tensions and conflicts, there's still that unity of purpose. And I would argue that that's not something that we have in the UK very much. I used to think that it's fine just to have this group doing protests here and that group doing petitions there and this group lobbying there. But actually, after going to Rojava and really experiencing what it's like to be part of a highly organized, powerful movement that's fighting for, you know, a free, dignified life and liberation for everybody, it slowly sunk into kind of my perception of what organization is. And it's the most revolutionary thing we can be doing is organizing ourselves and each other and creating strong, organized social movements. So the first few months I had in Rojava, I really struggled, actually. I found it really difficult to adjust to this different way of working. And I was constantly being asked to, instead of doing kind of things that were my personal choice or prioritizing my personal autonomy, to do things that were better for the collective, to think more of what the friends I was living with needed, or kind of what the movement needed, and not think about, well, where do I want to work? What do I want to get out of this experience? But actually, how do I serve the collective good? And I slowly kind of came to realize that I was putting the sort of me, the I, at odds with the us. And I was thinking, well, okay, some of these people here, they're really amazing, but all that they're doing is sacrificing the I for the us. But then I kind of had a bit of a realization that they're not doing that so much as seeing how much of the us is within every I, how you can't have an I without this us. We don't exist kind of as these individuals. And as a friend from the movement recently put it, that, you know, for her, the self-care is about looking at her collective and seeing how much they've progressed, how much they've accomplished, and so on. So I think really having that shift of this, who we are part of the collective, and we don't need to make the I smaller, but we need to make the us bigger. And that comes through organization. That comes through coordination and collective action and communication across our social movements. And it's really a weight off your shoulders, because then you can really, instead of firefighting, fighting, which was mentioned by Health and by Joe, and kind of going from one issue to another, you can be really strong in the fact that you're doing what you need to be doing, and your friends and people you work with are taking care of their bits of it as well. And this really hit home for me when the Turkish invasion happened in October, because it was at a time when it should have been in some ways the most chaotic and stressful, scary time. But then it really kind of consolidated that we were all exactly where we needed to be. And some of us were doing press work, some of us were doing, you know, healthcare, some of us were doing the military self-defense work. But we were all exactly where we needed to be, and we were all doing it in support of each other. So it was incredibly affirming and incredibly powerful. And it might seem like a bit of an extreme thing to compare to our situation in the UK, but we do need collective self-defense in the UK. We need it now in response to evictions, in response to police violence, cutting back welfare services, climate catastrophe. And we're going to need it increasingly, especially as the economic impact of the pandemic gets passed on to, you know, society, which we know it will. We're going to really need to have that unity and collective organization in order to actually collectively defend ourselves. So I'm not going to touch too much on kind of what stops us from being organized, because I think that I was touched on by Joe and by Helith, but I do want to make an observation that I think that a lot of the fragmentation and firefighting of the left social movements in the UK actually comes from not having this shared goal. And I've seen quite often really diverse groups and campaigns come together around a specific protest or around a specific conference or event or something like that. But once that clear goal is gone, they immediately fall to conflict, to fighting each other, to not being able to coordinate their actions. So I think having that like mutually reached, mutually agreed upon and articulated shared goal, collective strategy, is incredibly important for us to be able to work together. As well as, I think quite often we become quite insecure if we don't know exactly what we're fighting for. So we find it harder to work alongside people we disagree with. And as we mentioned in the session on connecting personal change and system change, if you have a shared goal, then there's lots of mechanisms that we can learn in order and apply in order to actually work alongside our people who we wouldn't maybe normally work with, and actually be mutually committed to each other's growth and learning and development. And kind of as Joe mentioned with the question of hope, like until we truly believe that we can create something big and powerful and coordinated that allows us to confront the forces we're up against and actually win, then we won't have the strength to actually build the kind of organization we need, the kind of coordinated system, whatever it looks like. So that kind of takes us to the question of, well, what does it look like? You know, I don't want to just raise all of the questions and all of the tensions without having some proposals. But fundamentally, whatever happens in the UK is going to come out of our social movements here. But I've got some sort of like rough, thoughts, trains of thought I want to pursue, which actually come from a lot of conversations with friends in the UK, as well as friends who are back in Rojava or working with the Kurdish Freedom Movement, because, you know, we need to come up with something that's quite specific to our situation here, which again is why it's important to sort of know our history and know our political context. So a more organized left would be more unified, and we'd be unified through diversity. We would communicate with each other, we would take joint action, we would have coordinated strategy, and we wouldn't expect political purity from the work that we do, because we're working with a huge range of people, but we are committed to learning together, making mistakes together, growing together. A more organized left would also be more accountable. So right now you have the people who believe in lobbying, doing lobbying, who believe in electoral politics, doing that, who believe in grassroots organizing, doing that. And there's not actually accountability between like the big national campaigns and the big political parties and electoral work. So the actual communities that we're claiming that we're, you know, fighting for, that we're defending. So I think that kind of accountability is a really important thing that we would gain from a more unified, coordinated social movement. Finally, I think that a more organized left could have better, be better for in terms of justice. So we would be redistributing resources when necessary, and we would also be more able to confront oppression and oppressive behaviors, because as we're working with so many people, you know, things do come up, but instead of excluding people from the groups, if we're actually really unified and really broad, we'd be able to deal with those behaviors. So for example, in the Kurdish women's movement, if a man in the movement has, you know, acted in a patriarchal way, all of the women across the movement, and we're talking like, you know, hundreds and, you know, thousands of groups here, will say, okay, well, we need to take joint action in order to address that behavior, whether it's of an individual or kind of a general tendency. And they will take action, and they will ask the men to intervene in some way. They will provide education. There will be kind of a structured approach to this instead of what happens in the UK, which is often the man will leave a group and just go to another and then go to another and go to another and just get kicked out from one after another. And I think all of this will make us more able to build community power and to actually confront the systems that are harming us, that are killing us. So it's one of those things that's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot of hard work. It's going to be really difficult and scary at times and frustrating at times. And it's going to be really slow a lot of the times, and then faster than we can handle at other times. But fundamentally, we can't afford to not do it. So it's work that we need to do, and we need to do together. So I'm encouraging and calling on all of you in whatever groups you're involved in, whatever campaigns you're involved in, to start thinking about this. You know, how can we work better in coordination? What kind of conversations should we be having? What kind of partnerships can we be forming? And through that, we can actually build community power and create a social movement that can fight and that can win. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Vian. So I'm going to try and sort of summarize a little bit, and then we're going to open to questions. And I know a few of you have been sending in questions already. So the kind of main points, I guess, that we've kind of kept coming back to are to know your history. Nick gave that great quote from the Zapatistas, looking backwards to move forwards, really rooting ourselves in that understanding, and using it to see where we are and where we're going. To be in it for the long haul, like revolution is a long-term project. Social change, transformation takes time. To see ourselves as part of society, not separate from it, and to organize in our neighborhoods with, you know, everyone that we know, really, to see everything that we do as part of social change. To see our movements as being inherently intertwined, so this comes back to the tree metaphor again, to build relationships, strategy, vision, and coordinated actions together, to transform our social relationships to ones of love and care and solidarity, because love is inherently revolutionary. There's another quote from the Kurdish Freedom Movement. They say a lot like, only 5% of your energy should be spent on fighting the enemy, and the other 95% on the system inside yourself. So this is also why we need to understand our history and understand what the state is and how it affects us, our mentalities and our ability to love and care for each other and the way that we relate to each other in society. To organize and believe that change is possible and act as though it is. So I will just say that also we've talked about the political system that's being developed in Rojava, and it's the like proposal from the Kurdish Freedom Movement, democratic confederalism. I won't explain that here because we've got a whole seminar on that. But a lot of the time people ask us what that would look like here. And it's important to say that it's not a cut and paste solution. So the new system that we develop, it has to be based on the context that we're actually in, just as it is there, and it's still constantly developing there. So we need to build ourselves from the ground up and develop a system from below that makes sense in these conditions, in this context. So I'll leave you with the questions that Vian asked at the end of our first session, which are, what kind of a world do we want to live in? How do we get there? And where do we start? So now we're going to move to questions. Somebody has asked, plenty of organizations and people from a variety of political backgrounds agree on the organization part of this. They're all about having party members and organization. So how would this practically be different? What would the politics that underlie it be? And how would this practically be expressed in the day-to-day by the way people work? So Vianne was just speaking on this. Do you want to take this one, Vianne?
Yep, I can give it a go. All right, I'll do my best. I mean, it's a big question, right? Like that is essentially what we need to answer together. I think that whatever organization, whatever form of organization we come up with, as I said, it needs to come from our kind of political context here, our political culture here. I think there is something to be said about just starting with conversations, starting with a round table, starting to figure out, well, what do we actually have in common? What do we want to accomplish together? And how do we want to do that? There's a lot of really interesting examples from the Kurdish freedom movement of, I guess, assemblies or forums that represent loads of different civil society organizations. And I think that will be a really important way to do it. And by civil society, I don't just mean like the kind of fancy ones. I mean, you know, community organizations, youth clubs, you know, not the ones which just think about kind of like engaging with the state, but organizations that actually develop community power, for example, like ACORN and London Renters Union are two examples. But I think we do need to create a way to pool all of those experiences, pool all of those perspectives, and then start working from there. I don't see that at some point in the UK in the near future, we're gonna have like this monolithic party that has members and that kind of administrates. I think what we're gonna come up with is a lot more organic than that, but there does need to be some kind of structure and some kind of accountability for each other. I don't know if that answers the question, but it's a big question to answer.
Yeah, there's a few big questions in here. Thanks a lot. So connected to this one, maybe I'll add this one in as well and then we can go to one of the others. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the synergy or relations between differing social movements and how best they can achieve their aims, especially in relation to the current moment, and how they can best appeal to those unaware of their struggle. Have we got Helef here? Is Helef on the call? It would be great if Helef could also answer some questions, but maybe she's not managed to come. Ah, you are there.
Hello. Hiya. Sorry.
Did you hear the question? Do you want me to repeat it?
Yes, please.
Okay. It says, I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the synergy or relations between differing social movements and how best they can achieve their aims, especially in relation to the current moment, and how they can best appeal to those unaware of their struggle.
So how, like the current movement of Black Lives Matter?
It doesn't specify one question.
And, well, how best, well, the thing is, I feel like Techmeal is like something really interesting. Like I think if you're working with people from a different background to, like, if you're a white person working and you're in a group of people of color, and you might have lots of unconscious sort of behaviors that are not okay, like Techmeal would be like a structured way to sort of call that stuff out. And like what's interesting is things like the women's movement, where women can come together and talk about our experiences as women organizing in groups of mixed genders. We can come and collectively call out things as well. And there's, I don't think there's no reason that like other groups of people that are oppressed couldn't do this as well, collectively as well as individually. And I hope I understood the question right, but like the barriers in people working together that come from like structural oppression and it being quite exhausting to work with privileged people in a lot of ways, that this, like, I feel like the systems they have in democratic confederalism are interesting, of like making sure that a group isn't like a proper group unless it's got a quota of representative people, say like of linguistic or ethnic minorities from the area, or gender balance. And that's like a way of it not feeling like a group that's just, you know, yeah, just one thing. I hope that's answered the question right. And there's, yeah, the examples of things they have as well, like co-chairing and things like this. But that's how I found interesting from the Kurdish movement, how they deal with these things, and maybe we can learn from.
Thanks, Helef. Yeah, there's another question here actually that relates to that one, to what you were just saying, which is a recurring theme has been about being more tolerant of allies and not expecting purity. Where do we draw the red lines that Helef mentioned? Do you want to come back on that one as well, or shall I go to someone else?
Yeah, so when I was talking about red lines, like I felt like in a practical way it means like your really difficult members of family or people in your community that might be saying really like wrong things on Facebook at the moment, trying to engage with them. But the red line is if they're behaving like this in front of or towards a person of colour, that you stand up for. You don't tolerate that, and that's where compassion and understanding and trying to help these people and learn their like awful sort of prejudices stop. Like that's when it's time to just be like, for me personally, I think it's different and it's something that needs to be talked about a lot, but like in trying to think about this stuff, like red lines are like when harm is being done and when how you can minimize harm in each situation and how you can basically do the most good. And like we haven't got like endless patience, maybe there's a limit to what we can do, but we can support each other to have patience to try, because just kind of like deleting these people from Facebook isn't going to change them, but like by chipping away, maybe there's hope. I don't know.
Thanks. Does one of the other speakers want to build on anything that Helef has said?
Would it be all right if I touch on it?
Yeah, sure.
So when I was in Rojava, something I was really struck by was that you have the kind of core of the movement who, you know, have like incredible political clarity and very strong principles and a very like deep analysis of the political situation. And then you have this whole spectrum of other people who engage with the movement and engage in the democratic and federalist system. So I think it's just important to not just think about politics as, you know, the people who I'm with and everyone else who I'm against, but there were actually a huge number of organizations, individuals, or actually social groups, whether that was based on religion or ethnicity or region or family, who were in many ways in tension with the movement that drove the Rojava revolution, but who still participated in some way. And I think we need to make sure that we don't see them as kind of mutually exclusive, that you're either, you know, of the movement or you're against it, and kind of look at something a bit more pluralistic almost, and be able to have the political clarity within ourselves and within the kind of direction that we're moving towards, that will actually enable us to work with people who don't necessarily agree with us. It doesn't mean that we're all exactly, you know, around the same table all the time, but we're still somehow working together.
Nick, do you want to contribute anything to this, or should I start a new question?
I guess so. There's one point that I was going to make in the history section, but touches on a couple of these of the places that I feel like these questions are coming from, which is how we think about unity. And I think one thing that came up in previous seminars that's worth remembering here is that the unity in the Kurdish freedom movement, yes, there's organizational unity from this long history, but at this point there's such a diversity of organizations that the real unity is the shared system of values that all of them operate on. And those values are kind of bottom line ways of working that help you figure out exactly these questions like where a red line has to fall in one situation versus another. Where one value in terms of keeping a movement together is less important when it suddenly becomes really important again. Now, obviously, it's easy in one sense to say that, and in another, the question immediately comes, what do we mean by a value, and where do these values come from? How do we develop them? And there I would return to this historical perspective. One of the arguments I referenced that seems to be being borne out now is that the first state systems, when they're very rare historically, as I mentioned, and for them to come about, they require some kind of shift in worldview, a shift in worldview that views the existence of permanent hierarchy as necessary and makes people willing at the end of the day to give more of what they produce and to essentially start creating class and economic relationships. Now, if that's an essential part of the coming about of states, that means that worldviews are a really important way that we need to overcome them too. So we need to figure out what the points of unity are that unite a potential worldview that all of us in this idea for a movement beyond, for free life beyond the state and beyond patriarchy and beyond all of these oppressive systems, what would a worldview like that look like? And this comes back to these converging of different struggles. What is it that makes it feel organic for people embedded in one struggle to see that reflected in another struggle, not in a way that seeks to reduce it or to co-opt that movement, like Helleth referenced the socialist groups that unfortunately make a habit of that, but in a way that that recognizes both the particularity of that struggle, for example, the Black liberation struggle, and also its common roots in these oppressive systems, i.e. the nation state, colonialism, empire, capitalism, which then unites that struggle with, for example, the Kurdish freedom movement or with the Palestinian liberation movement. There were lots of people sharing sharing things which paired together George Floyd with similar things that had happened in recent weeks in Turkey, where a young Kurd was killed just for listening to Kurdish music, and another Palestinian was killed on the streets of Palestine by the forces of occupation. Now, on one level, these are very different struggles, but there is something that unites them that meant that without anyone needing to, obviously there are long histories of connections between these movements too, but people didn't need that to recognize their unity, the unity that already exists there. So in terms of finding that, then it's working through that together to arrive at the shared worldview on what we're fighting against and what unites all of our struggles. And if we keep those really clearly in mind, then some of these contradictions start to become manageable and we can work through them.
Thanks a lot. I've got another one here that I want to go to Helleth, I think. So it says, what are your thoughts on youth creating the foundations for a creative and radical way of working in unity that embraces diversity?
How young people how young people contribute to movements. I think when we sort of are in like left wing sort of groups, a lot of them sort of look young, and you know, that's the thing that people feel that it's like a young, well, there's like young in your 20s and then there's young people, like the people that were doing the climate strike, and I guess maybe that's what this question's referring to. And the thing is, like, because of the things that are, you know, the how we leave the world is affecting young people, there's like an integrity there that nobody can argue with. And like, I think from the Kurdish youth movement, what I've heard of it, it talks about like that sort of the movement that there's a lot of the protests and actions and stuff and brings like more creative action rather than the more different sort of community-based things like music, culture and things like this that, you know, go into like music, they go into like the struggle, like, you know, a struggle without any music behind it or art, it's not, you know, these things that inspire people and give people the sort of the fuel and inspiration, like these are like important parts of struggle, and young people are a really important part of that. But yeah, like I suppose there's also like the side of the often, because like from the anarchist movement, for example, a lot of people get burnt out from how intense the firefighting, like Joe was talking about, is. There's like kind of, it looks like there's an age when people just stop being involved in stuff, and there's like that it's as if the kind of hope for changing kind of goes. And with the Kurdish freedom movement, that doesn't seem to be the same thing. The kind of energy of revolution that you have when you first learn about these ideas, they carry people through their whole lives, and I think that's really amazing.
Yeah, thanks for that. I was thinking, because you've been obviously involved in the Welsh language movement, as you said, and I can imagine that that has quite a different character in terms of youth involvement.
Yeah, well, when we were in school, my friends, they were 15, and they got arrested for painting on a boot shop because boots didn't have any of their signs in English. And I remember school friends doing things like that and it just being sort of normal, and there was like a lot of like organized music events in Welsh for the language, for young people, and, you know, listening to music in the language. It was kind of like, it was more of a political act years ago, before things like the Welsh Language Channel and stuff was one, but that kind of culture sort of carried things. And when Welsh language culture was protest music, it's kind of you know, developed since then. But like that kind of young, when people grow up with something, it's, you know, it's not such a, they kind of make fun of you at school for like, oh, you've been with Cymdeithas, so you anti-English, but it's kind of a joke because it's not an anti-English thing, the language struggle. But it's like, yeah, and there's things like that play out in schools. Our school got graffitied because they said it was a bilingual school and someone else said it was a Welsh school. So things like that just happened all the time kind of thing.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that a lot. It does remind me a lot of like in the Kurdish movement, the youth are like really, really a strong force in that movement. And you know, a lot of people know that the women's movement is organized autonomously, but actually the youth movement is also organized autonomously, and youth are seen as like really this sort of, you know, bringing a lot of energy for change and revolution. I think we might have time for one final question. Does anyone want to come back on that?
On the youth question, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think one thing to say about the perspective that the Kurdish freedom movement has on the importance of youth in the struggle, is, again, refers to this idea of thinking about how we are socialized as people. So socialized can be a bit of a complex term, so I'll explain it quickly. So this understanding of what socialization means is a recognition that all of our sense of ourself, our identities, our understanding of who we are and where we fit in the world and how the world itself works, doesn't just come from heaven, or we're not born with it. It comes from the fact that we're embedded in social relationships, like Joe was saying at the beginning. And so the logical takeaway from that perspective on how we develop as humans is that people who have less have been socialized less in this world, in this system, are more open to seeing how it could be arranged differently, are less worn down by the domination of the state, have naturalized less these systems of oppression. And so it's really important then that those people take a really leading role in how we build a new society. It's the perspective that the sort of person asking the question implied, like, what do we think of the creative role of the youth? Well, the Kurdish Freedom Movement says that the creative role of the youth is essential to any movement for a free life, any movement that really looks to change social relationships. And we can sort of see some of how this works in some of the cliches that we have in our own societies, right? When we say, oh, you get more right wing as you get older, things like that. People who are older, the cliche goes, obviously it's not entirely true, tend to side with the system slightly more. So yeah, the movement thinks that it's incredibly important.
Thanks a lot. So we're going to wrap up now. I just wondered if Fionn wanted to come in with a final word.
I think I'd like to kind of quickly touch on one of the big questions, which was kind of replacing, you know, vertical government with horizontal government. And, you know, as you guys who've been following the seminar series so far know, that the Kurdish Freedom Movement in many ways sees government, or at least sees the state, as a problem. So it's not just the question of reorganizing government itself, but changing the relationship it has to society. So actually, again, not just saying no to government, but saying yes to society, and having that like incredibly strong grassroots community movement. So that kind of is the model of democratic confederalism, where society administrates itself through a system of devolving power. But it's not just the question of making everything horizontal, it's also, once again, a question of organization. You know, deciding how you create these democratic entities, but also whose voices you kind of lift up. And this goes back to the question on youth, and also the point on sort of national and ethnic and religious unity that somebody mentioned in the chat, which is that according to the principles of democratic confederalism, whatever ethnic minority or majority exists in an area is always represented in the assemblies and committees of that area of administration. So in Northeast Syria, you have Kurdish people, you have Arabic people, you have Assyrians, Armenians, Turkmen, Chechens. So it's a very diverse area. So wherever there is a group, they are represented. Same with women, of course, with a very high percentage quota, and also same with youth. So for the Syrian Democratic Council, which is one of the main sort of top level political bodies for the whole region of North and East Syria, the youth are represented. You know, there are two youth delegates to that council. And that kind of shows that it's not just saying, yeah, okay, yeah, the youth over there, they're great, they're making demos, they're being rowdy, but actually saying, and we need these voices around the table, and we're gonna bring them in. And when we discuss really important issues, we're gonna make sure that they're present, because they're a crucial part of our society.
Great, thanks so much for that. So we're out of time today. So this was the last of our current series of seminars. You can watch the other four on our website, which I think this is the magic part where I say announcements and they appear in the chat as if by magic. So we are probably going to be arranging more seminars. They might have quite a different format. We've been learning a lot as we've gone along. This has been quite experimental. And we really value your feedback. So some people have sent in feedback as we've gone along, and that's actually really helped us to refocus and sort of shift the way that we've been doing things a little bit as we've gone along. So please send feedback about the sessions if you have any time. Somebody's gonna put a link for that, I believe, also in the chat. Thanks. okay, we've got some events coming up. So there's a group in Scotland called Scottish Solidarity with Kurdistan, very good friends of ours. They're running a series called Kurdish Tuesdays once a month. And the next one is tomorrow at 7 o'clock, and it's on the Boycott Turkey campaign. So it's about why Boycott Turkey, what that campaign is, and how to go about doing that. There's going to be some speakers there. from different structures in the Kurdish movement and academics and things like that. There's a webinar series on that's put on by the Kurdish Women's Movement as well. The first one was on Sunday. That's every Sunday. So the next one is next Sunday at 6 p.m. Yeah, so it's a 7 p.m. It's 7 p.m. Central European time, so it's 6 p.m. If you're listening from the UK. And then there's the week after that as well. Oh, yeah, how to weave our future. Okay, yeah, so this one says the coronavirus pandemic as a litmus test of capitalist modernity, and there's going to be panelists. There is an email address, I believe, that you can, oh yeah, people have put stuff in the chat. Okay, there's an email address that you can write to in order to be on the Zoom call, as it were, of these events, or otherwise you can watch them live streamed on YouTube. There is a campaign to raise money for water projects in Rojava, to raise money for £100,000 for lots of different kinds of water projects connected to women's cooperatives and repairing and finding alternatives to systems that Turkey has been attacking during the recent conflicts, which are ongoing, obviously. So there's been a problem with donations to this website, but it's still possible to donate through PayPal. And it seems that the issue with the website is going to be solved quite soon also. Then we've got... There is research going into the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic on social relationships, and particularly on women involved with or connected to social movements. And this is being carried out by the Genealogy Committee in Europe. So we've talked a bit about genealogy before. It's the social science that's being proposed by the Kurdish Women's Movement. So there's a short questionnaire of 10 questions, and they'd really like anybody to help filling those in. Somebody has also dropped that in the chat. And tomorrow morning, this was the latest announcement that we just got. Tomorrow morning, there's going to be a press conference given by the people of Şengal and Mahmur. So last night, there was actually bombings by Turkish aeroplanes in three different regions of Kurdistan. So one on Mahmur, which is a refugee camp in South Kurdistan, which is North Iraq. And also in Şengal. I think they're all in North Kurdistan, South Kurdistan, actually. So they're all in North Iraq. Şengal, you might remember, is where the Islamic State committed a huge horrendous massacre and genocide of the Yazidi people, who were a minority. And so it's very symbolic indeed that these are the areas that are being attacked. It will be really important to go to that press release and to keep an eye on the news. The Kurdish news is where you'll find out about this kind of stuff, because it often doesn't make it, unfortunately, into English language. Well, English, you know, mass media that's owned by billionaires. So we're going to close, as we always do, with a bit of music. Can somebody put the, because sometimes people want to know what the music is as well. I don't know if someone wants to put the music video into the chat, but yeah, apart from that, we've really enjoyed doing these seminars, and we're really glad that so many people have come. Please do fill out the feedback form and stay in touch.
جدایی وقت روزو هی و ابزار او کن میموزینه تب هلبستن جیگر خونه سرهلدان زمانه کرده سرهلدان جوانه کرده سرهلدان جیانه گونده سرهلدان ریانه دوره سرهلدان چارپرچیه سرهلدان حلبچیه سرهلدان دوزامه تولامه سوزامه سرهلدان جیانه ی سرهلدان لسرچیای سرهلدان لزندانه ی سرهلدان لهردریه سرهلدان به اوبا به سرهلدان جهب نابه برخودانه تولهلدانه سرهلدان چاو زمانه سرهلدان آزادیه سرهلدان دوناهیه جیانه جیانه سرهلدان جیانه Serhildan, 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 Jiyane, hey hey, Serhildan, Jiyane. Em bir yek dengi bandıkın Serhildan, Jiyane. Serhildan, 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 Jiyane. ez rojla tu başvurum ez kurmancı soranime ez zaza ubadinime çavemin libenda feronia çaveteme tu çavi ez estirime sestri çaveteme azadina veteye ez erobenda teme tevere ez üte bugün yekşi bol ola teme ez kez ku soru zirim tici rengin roju seri ez evina memuzinim tu canıç geri huyni ez huyna şehidanım tı huyna veri tani ez serhıldanım dünya zani bi azadi jiyan navi ez jiyan tu gerilalı ser jiyan tu serhılda biz tu yeke adare em di sabun yek bra Ez gülüm tü gülistani, tu havin uzivistani Ez berfim tü barani, ez keokum tü azmani Ez çavım tü jizimani, ez rezanım tü destani Ez nevrozum tü agri, ez fıratım tü dicliyi Ez destim tü kelepçi, ez mürünüm tü jiyani Ez radızım tü jiyari, ez heyranım tü delali Ez kavnum tü jihayali, ez davatım tü temmuri Ez davulum tü zurneyi, ez dilanım tü govendi Ez merdinim tü amili, ez kerkukum tü hevleri Ez pırsım tü jibersivi, ez betirsim tü dersimi Ez natırsım tü zani, berhodanım serhildanım tü jiyani Serhildan, 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 Jiyane, hey hey, Serhildan, Jiyane. Em bir ek dengi bandıkın serhildan.